Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
So Liam, as you were saying, enterprise.
So picking up on a thread from last week, right? And I think, I don't know if we've done it in the past, but like a two-part episode.
We've done so many.
Have we?
Yeah.
We've done follow-up sessions, but it was last week was like, we're going to put a pin in something and we're going to have to do a part two.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm thinking there was like Return of the Mac parts one and two.
Yeah. The ADD, the Adaconf ones.
Yeah.
But I guess that's different. That's
we did have Is Git Shit and then Is Grace Ace.
True. Yeah, but that was unintentional.
Was it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. Anyway, that's so long ago now. But I guess what we're talking about here is a topic that was closely related to what we spoke about last week. And we mentioned it in the tail end of the episode.
Yeah. And I specifically cut you off and said, stop. That's the next episode.
That's right. So let's pick up that thread where we were.
Yeah.
And so this week we wanted to cover the idea of enterprise development. And, you know, I just want to leave it as open as that, because I think like a good place to start would be to define what enterprise development is.
So I'm looking at the website and I'm looking at last week's episode, last week's episode at the time of recording. And it says, and there's a teaser for next episode, picking up the related question, what even is enterprise and do you actually need it?
Exactly. That's exactly it. And actually, I wasn't even reading that page. But like I said, I think if we start with the definition,
yep.
Because I think, and to me, enterprise is a very loose term, especially in the space of software development and software engineering. Yeah. And I think a lot of people have their own definitions.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because to me, it's like I always learned that word. My first exposure to the word was business studies when they speak about the three things that make up business, which is enterprise, capital, and labor.
Gosh, I can't even remember that far back. Yep.
Don't you have an MBA?
No.
Oh. Okay, well then.
No, I got a master's in business leadership, not administration.
Oh, right, I see. You've got an MBL.
Yeah. That was a deliberate choice. And it was at one of those stages as a little, again, another aside that we do. I wanted to study for the sake of studying. Like, I wanted to learn.
Yeah.
And going down the MBA path and anything around along those lines was more just to do it for the sake of getting a piece of paper and to getting a few extra letters behind my name. Whereas focusing on the leadership aspect, it's something that I wanted to do and something I wanted to learn about.
Yeah.
So that was more just something that's worth a lot more rather than trying to go down that MBA path. Anyway, that's a bit of an aside.
You can buy an MBA at Coles these days, so you're probably not wrong.
Exactly. And that's the point, right? There's a book too, isn't it? Like the personal MBA or something. Is that it?
Yeah, I think so. I probably. Well, yeah. If only I had the entirety of human knowledge at my disposal, at my fingertips. The personal MBA.
Are you running Claude on the side there?
Josh Kaufman? No, and this is just a search engine.
Primitive.
Personal MBA by Josh Kaufman. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Right, you can get it in the book. And I guess my point there is, like, that content, this is completely off topic, but like that content is freely available and you don't need to pay to go to university to get that content, right? And a lot of, when I was deciding what I wanted to study, you know, a lot of it was all also about, well, you do the MBA for the networking side of it rather than the content.
Yeah.
Right. Arguably, that probably would have helped me at this stage in my career where I'm at right now, but.
I disagree, but this is a whole other topic, but yeah. Bro. I mean, I think if you were looking to climb a specific ladder, which you are not.
Correct. Anyway, so, and that would be the enterprise ladder, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Just to segue back into, back on topic.
I think let's take a trip back through time and go back to the conversation we had where I first pitched this topic, because it actually, you know, we did say let's pick up on it from last week, but there was something there was a conversation I was having with someone that sparked this, and I thought let's talk about that.
Yep.
Do you remember what it was?
No, you know my memory is terrible with these things.
Okay, so we will definitely need to define what we mean by enterprise, and let's do that soon. But to give you some context, right, the discussion was along these lines. I was talking to someone about what stack to build a product on, basically, or what stack a product was built on.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of talk about open source, self-hosting, or not self-hosting, but, you know, using really open source products, open source stack. So it was like MySQL, essentially. And, you know, it doesn't really matter what the API layer was, but it was, you know, Node and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff like that. And you know, running it on a VPS and all this kind of thing, right? And I think that's fine for a prototype. And I've said many times that one of the gaps in the Azure story, in my opinion, is the scale-up story. Because if you want to run your whole stack on a VPS for $5 a month, you can. And you can run MySQL or Postgres, and you're not going to get scaling, and you're not going to get security, and you're not going to get all these other things. But if that doesn't matter to you, then that's okay. You just have to know what the decision is that you're making. Anyway, so here's the thing, right? So the conversation was about exactly this, right? Azure has, it's not that it has a, well, actually it does. It does, it has a high bar to entry. And in fact, this is something I'm talking about at Slash New next week, but it doesn't have a particularly high cost bar, but it doesn't have the, this isn't going to cost you anything, because the free, everything on the free tier on Azure, you know, they do say this isn't for production workloads, but it isn't for production workloads, and you can't run production workloads on it specifically because of the cold starts, really, more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
There is actually a new serverless container, sorry, not serverless, there's new Azure Container Apps. God, I can't remember what it is, but there's a new Azure Container Apps offering coming out that's probably going to change that. It's closer to what we spoke to Brandon about that they run on AWS. I don't want to go on that tangent now. Anyway, the point is, if you want to run your stack on Azure, let's say at a minimum you want compute and a database, you're probably looking at between $30 and $100 a month for your prototype, for your dev instance, whatever, right? So there is an argument to be made to say just build it on a VPS. Now, this isn't what I do, right? What I do is I self-host. I have my own resources at home. I've got a couple of little servers, and I run things on there. And I've got it set up so that I can access it remotely, and I can give other people access as well. I'm using Lex Encrypt wildcard certificate, and I've got a proxy running, and I've got Tailscale running, so people can connect from anywhere if I want them to. And I run most of the same resources that I would run on Azure. And then if something gets to the point where I need something more, then I look at deploying it. So, but you know, anyway, this is not what everyone does. But the point is that the choices that you make early are choices that will effectively lock you in. Unless, of course, you're Susan from Collider and her team, and then you can do something that most of us wouldn't dream of. Changing the engine mid-flight, she called it. We should get her on and talk about that. That was a very cool story. Anyway,
we've said that for a lot of people from AdaComp.
I know, we're so slack. There's so many people that we should talk to, and that have said that they're happy to come and talk to us. Anyway, where was I? Okay, so the conversation was, you know, why don't we just build it with, I don't know, PHP and MySQL? And I said, you know, that's fine, but you know, you lock yourself into that, and it wasn't just that. I honestly can't remember what the conversation was. It was definitely PHP and MySQL was the stack. I can't remember what the hosting was, but basically something came up in the conversation, and I was sort of saying, look, if you use different technologies, or if you host it on Azure, you get like enterprise capability. Yeah. And you know, yes, there's a separate conversation here to have about what does that mean and do you need it. But the response that I got, which is what prompted this conversation, was, well, Facebook runs on PHP and MySQL.
Mm. Like,
Facebook uses it, and they're massively bigger scale than any organization that, you know, you've ever built an infrastructure for, or that, you know, that we've done this kind of work for. And it's an interesting point, but there's a problem with it. And the problem is, yes, but you're not Facebook. And this is where this cost discrepancy comes in, and the disparity comes from. And when you understand it, it kind of makes sense that $30 to $100 bar is there. What I mean by that is this: Facebook doesn't run MySQL. Facebook runs Facebook's MySQL. Like, they haven't committed back everything that they're doing with it back into the public repo. First problem. Second problem, same thing with PHP. The far bigger problem is Facebook has tens of thousands of engineers to keep that running, right? You don't.
Well, that depends. Is that before or after all the recent layoffs?
Before.
Yeah.
Now they've just got Llama running it, I guess. But no, I mean, even, you know, frankly, even if you've got a team of 100 engineers maintaining your infrastructure, that's a lot more than what this person had, which was no one. And the point is that all of those things, like scale, like security, like so on and so forth, there's a high bar to get that working properly in Azure.
Yep.
But what you get out of the box is a lot more than what you get by standing up your own PHP instance, a lot more. And more than that, you get the capability to scale up, not just in terms of compute and hosting and you know, number of concurrent users that can query your database, but in terms of your security posture, your maturity, you know. So the reason that the bar is higher is because you're paying more, because you're getting a bunch of things that you don't get without it. And it's not that you don't need that team of 10,000 engineers, but Microsoft has a team of thousands of engineers to do all this for you. And that's what you pay for. Now, granted, you should get more out of the box by default, but I don't want to go into that now. And again, this is something I'm going to touch on at Slash New next week, but separate topic. But yeah, so that's where this came from. It was, I raised this with you and I said, okay, but you know, it's all well and good saying do this free cheap option because this massive, massive tech giant does it. It's like, yeah, but you're not that massive tech giant. And that's not just a throwaway comment. It's a meaningful distinction, as I've just said. And your response, which was very interesting, was, yes, but do you need enterprise?
Yep. And I still stand by that.
Yeah.
That question.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people, and given our experience, like that's what we know, that's what we do. And I'm not saying it's wrong or right, but I guess it's the golden hammer argument, right? If that's all we know, then that's all we're going to apply. That's all we're going to be worried about. But do we really need to apply that golden hammer right here, right now in this, for this given problem set?
Yeah, yeah, it's a valid question. And we always talk about our core responsibility as consultants to be helping the customer find the right solution and picking the right tool for the right job. In my case, I would say that it's probably not, I'm not going to say it's not my golden hammer. It is, right? But I do run a home lab and I do run all of these open source things myself. And, you know, I run my own little mini stack at home. So, you know, I do that stuff and I have built, run and maintain these things for different organizations at different scales. I have clients now that run stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, I have and do work on other cloud platforms like Google and AWS, and they have things that are better. Well, no, I'm sorry. Google GCP is just awful and there's no redeeming qualities. I'm sorry, it doesn't. AWS, on the other hand, does. The thing that I like about Azure, the thing that makes me like it more than the others is the UI, to be honest. Like trying to find something in GCP, trying to find something in AWS is painful. Even trying to have a view of all your resources is painful. Azure has a lot of problems. And I'll admit that it's my go-to because I like the UI, which is a really, really bad reason.
Yep.
But there it is. But anyway, no, you're right. Like the question that you have to ask. But I mean, I think, yes, so the question, do you need enterprise? Is this the right tool for the right job? Is the right question. But you do also, you know, we talk a lot about Yagni, right? And, you know, we don't want to do premature optimization. But you do need to ask the question, are you building this on here? And is this where it's always going to run? Do you need to scale it? What's your exit strategy? Is there an escape hatch? What's the plan? Because when someone says to me something like, I'm just going to do this, and from there, I'm going to grow to, you know, 10,000 users, that's a red flag.
Well, it is, unless they've got 10,000 users already using the platform and they're looking for a big upheaval, right?
Yeah.
But that, I guess that's kind of not exactly what we're talking about. But
and in fairness, probably 10,000 users is something that you could handle on that stack.
Well, you know. Interesting. When I was thinking about this topic, I think it was either today or yesterday, it reminds me of really like super early in my career. And I've spoken about in the past other systems I've worked on in the past, but I'm talking even predating those. And my boss.
Prehistoric.
Prehistoric. To the point, I'll give it away now, is my boss said to me, it sent me to a Microsoft training day or a conference or something they had. He's like, they've got this tool called SharePoint, and it's going to be the next big thing coming out of Microsoft.
Yeah.
Right. And this was SharePoint 2. So because the history being that they originally bought the SharePoint platform, then they completely stuffed it up. And then this was their big rebranding of it and to the SharePoint that we know today, the origins of the SharePoint we know today. Well, okay, great. Now, if you think like we were in sort of an MSP kind of environment and, you know, biggest environments we were managing might have been organizations of, I don't know, 20 to 30 people.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at the docs coming out of Microsoft and they're talking about SMBs, small, medium businesses over in particularly targeted to the States. And their numbers were along the lines of hundreds to 100 to 500 was their kind of bracket. Right?
Yeah.
And then their enterprise levels were 10,000 plus employees.
So there's your answer.
right? And I just remember looking at like what their reference architectures were, and I'm just blown away looking at it going, they're talking about having multiple web servers, multiple application servers, multiple database servers, load balancers, you know, redundant infrastructure, the whole lot. I'm like,
yeah,
none of our clients are going to be paying for any of this shit.
Yeah.
And this was where it really clicked to me. Like, enterprise is this complete behemoth of a world that basically, and sort of in contrast to what we were talking about last week, but it is exclusive to, like I said, the big end of town.
I mean, I guess it depends how you define the big end of town, because that's effectively the kind of solution that I used to build before I was a developer, or before I was what I was doing before I was a developer. So, but I mean, when I was an engineer, an infrastructure engineer, that's exactly what I used to build. Yep. So I used to build like geo-redundant SQL clusters and virtual infrastructures. I was an Exchange and Active Directory engineer primarily. So I used to build exactly that for Exchange. You know, you'd have multiple client application servers, database availability groups.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I used to build all this. And, you know, the kinds of organizations that would quote unquote need that, you know, we're talking around the sort of 150, 200 up would be, I mean, don't get me wrong, I've built that kind of thing for much larger, you know, clients as well. Like, but even then, like, you know, I mean, I've never built one for a major multinational, the kind where you have hundreds of nodes in your distributed exchange forest infrastructure. I've never built that kind of thing. But, you know, we're talking about anywhere from, you know, 1 to 2,000, maybe 3,000 users, all the way down to 150.
Yeah.
And they all more or less land on the same architecture. Some of the details differ. Some, you know, and you know, certainly the scale differs in some ways, and the redundancy and the disaster recovery and all that sort of stuff differs. And things now are very different as well. Anyway, and cloud was supposed to be something that levels the playing field there, and in many ways it does. But you're right that Microsoft said this is the reference architecture, and that then means really doesn't matter what the scale is. The interpretation is this is what you're expected to do.
Yeah.
And if you look at, I mean, we're really going back here, but do you remember Microsoft Small Business Server?
Yep.
Do you remember what the number one distinguishing feature of Small Business Server was?
The thing that it stood out for was, one, that it basically had everything, but two, was it was capped at a maximum license usage.
So it's from a technical...
Oh, it was single server, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, not necessarily, but yes, fundamentally. That one server that does everything was the key distinguishing feature, right? So what you couldn't have, or what, according to Microsoft, and again, lots of companies that did it, you're not supposed to have Exchange and a domain controller running on the same box.
Yeah.
With Small Business Server, you could do that, and it was supported. That's the from a technology perspective, Exchange on the domain controller is literally like the major technological distinguishing feature of Small Business Server.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of organizations that would do that. And there were lots of organizations that would buy one box. And there were lots that would actually not even buy Small Business Server. They were literally running like Windows Server 2003 or whatever. And they would run it as a domain controller, and they would run Exchange on it, and they would have multiple SQL instances, and they would have SharePoint, and they would have all these other things, and it would run on one box, and it would fall over, you know? Like, they'd have it on a UPS, they'd have a tape backup drive, and, you know, once every couple of days, the IT guy would go in there and reboot it. People would tolerate the outage for like 10, 15 minutes because that was okay.
Yep.
And that's probably something that's changed, right? Is our attitude that, you know, everything must be up and available all the time, but maybe it doesn't.
Well, I think that's it. And I guess this goes back to my point about the questioning, do you need enterprise? What are the expectations of your user base? A lot, and I'm not going to say all, but a lot of the systems I've worked on are generally internal systems, right? Where it's a contained user base.
Yeah.
Where you're not talking about thousands or tens of thousands of concurrent users. You're talking about a workload that goes basically Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, give or take, with maybe a few indexing/reporting and what other scheduled tasks happening after hours.
Yeah.
But the need for that level of availability is less critical. So I guess the point there is around that question of, do you need that upfront expense in not just the hosting and the infrastructure side, but also the engineering side?
Yeah.
Right. engineering a fully fault-tolerant, robust, 99.99999% available system, all the nines, every single one of them,
yeah,
that comes at a cost.
Yeah.
And is that cost required? And I think to sort of tie this back to last week's topic, being that, you know, bespoke software shouldn't be out of the realm of the non-enterprise, right? Some of the cost involved in that engineering effort can be eliminated.
Or redirected to better use, right?
Exactly. By recognizing the fact that you don't need all of those enterprise requirements up front.
Yeah.
Maybe 99.99999% uptime is not required.
Yeah.
Maybe 99.9 is. And like, it sounds like it's only 0.009 difference, but it's in those final few nines that require a shit ton of money, effort, and engineering expertise to maintain that availability, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, the difference between something that fails over seamlessly with no downtime and something that fails over with, you know, a minute downtime is immense.
That's right. And I can't remember, I'm just trying to bring up the stats now, but something like Five9's availability over a year is a matter of seconds over the entire year, I think. I can't remember. Was it 365? Yeah, I can't remember. It's a matter of seconds or minutes. I can't remember exactly. And my point there is, do you need that level of uptime?
Yeah. I mean, these are the questions we should be asking. But I mean, look, there is more to it than just uptime. I mean, security is one that often concerns me. And it's one that often I find clients don't think about, consider to the level that I would like them to.
Yep.
But again, like, you know, you don't necessarily need, you know, mil-spec, right? You don't need an IRAP approved, you know, multi-layer firewall gap, you know, military grade security solution, right?
No.
But, you know, what you don't want is something that is exposed that shouldn't be exposed. But like, actually, I want to take a step back, right? Because something that you said, I think it's interesting. So to me, when I talk about, when people say, what do you mean when you say you do enterprise software?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a clean explanation and it's not 100% accurate, but it is the simplest way to explain it, I find. When we're talking about enterprise software, we're generally talking about internal systems.
That's how I try to explain it. It's the systems that businesses use to basically run their show in-house, yes.
Yeah. And it's not 100% accurate because a lot of enterprise software is commercial, meant for others. But the thing that's interesting is that something that you said a moment after that is that sometimes we're building software for an in-house team and they don't need enterprise because then that's a different meaning because then we're talking about, well, what? We're not talking about scale. Are we talking about cost? We're talking about quote unquote the big end of town.
I never thought about that, sort of that contradiction that I've just mentioned there. And I guess in my mind, this comes back to, again, talking about bringing up last week's episode was traditionally speaking, the in-house development was only done by those larger enterprises.
Yeah.
Right. And they were the ones that had the budgets for the big dev teams and those big, big projects internally.
Yeah.
They're the ones that have, you know, their own infrastructure teams. So there's a lot more overheads and requirements to get your work signed off by making sure that the infrastructure team are happy with how things are.
Yeah.
Like, and again, traditionally speaking, well before the concept of DevOps and you know, the idea that we start to bring the development team and the ops team together, which I think we've spoken in the past, sort of we've gone back the other way now.
Yeah.
And just abusing that term DevOps, but that's another point. But I think that's how I justified in my head is, yes, they're internal tools, but it's more that internal tools at that large enterprise level versus we're looking at, you know, and particularly me, my current space is looking to help smaller businesses. And if we're looking to make it more affordable and make this process make the process more affordable for them to be able to start competing, then something's going to give. And it's that enterprise robustness that I don't think is necessary.
So let me ask you some questions here, right? So I think what you're saying is a smaller business can have a bespoke software solution, but they don't need and shouldn't have to pay for something that gives them redundancy so that they don't notice the downtime and scale across thousands of users.
100%.
Right. But does that also mean that they don't need, so if you think about the security triad, right? So confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information, right? So we're talking about availability. They may not have as severe availability requirements, or they may not have the budget for it. So that's something they would compromise. But what about security? But what about confidentiality? What about integrity? Are we saying that the smaller businesses should also not have their data protected? Should they not have good recovery options? Should they not have decent security, you know, protections around unauthorized access? And this is where I don't think that they should have to make that choice. I don't think that these things should have to be for these large enterprises. But like you said, there are concessions that you can make and there are things that you can do. And one of the first things that you can do is not have it publicly accessible.
Absolutely. Right? I've built systems that I'm, and that's part of the security posture is knowing full well that this is not available outside of the local network.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I mean, that being said, like, that's not the be all and end all either, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it is a strong barrier to make sure that,
I think what we're saying, right, is that there's lots of different levers you can pull and lots of dials you can turn that ramp up various things that you get and equally ramp up the cost, right?
Oh, absolutely. Like, and the difference between handling 10 concurrent users and handling 10,000 is significant.
Yeah. When you're talking about cloud, it is, but it's not that significant. But it's very significant in terms of those 10 users can be served from a box under someone's desk in the office.
So you're thinking there purely about whether or not the infrastructure can handle 10 to 10,000. And these days, you know, I mean, current .NET 10, .NET 11, like ASP.NET right now can handle tens of thousands of concurrent users quite easily, right?
Yeah.
But it's not just that. It's the processes and the sub-processes and the entire systems thinking that goes around it to make sure that, you know, you've got the right level of locks in place on certain data structures, the database, right? It's not just whether or not the web server can handle those concurrent requests. It's whether or not the system itself can handle the current concurrent users.
Yes. Okay, sorry. And there's a tangent that I want to explore.
And to me, there is a significant engineering effort to be able to handle a larger number of concurrent users. When if you can take that off the table at the early stages, you can work around that.
Yeah. Okay. There's a couple of things. So the first thing is where I was going, it was along those lines, right? But what I was saying is there's all these knobs and dials and you can crank it up and it can cost a lot of money. And those larger enterprises will pay that because they feel that they need it. But what that means is that then the cost of bespoke software becomes conflated with those expenses. And that's a part of it that the, again, quote unquote, smaller end of town doesn't necessarily need. And that's, mm-hmm. I think, one of the things that contributes to that myth of cost, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of scale and in terms of handling 10 versus 10,000 versus a million users, sure, but that's one thing. But there's something else that you said, right? And this is something that I think is important. It's can the system handle it? Is it designed to it? And I don't think that's just a question of scale, because what you said was that it has the right locks. And I think what you need is you need a solution that is architected and built sufficiently for your needs, right? And if your needs are that you've got decent security in place, even if it's authorization rules, right? Even if you're a small shop of five people and one of you does payroll and has access to everyone else's salary that no one else should have, hypothetical example, right? If you're getting a bespoke system that handles that, doesn't matter what the scale is, it needs to be secured. It needs to be tested for security. It needs to be stress tested for security. And you need to have confidence in it. And if you've got an engineering budget and you're using that budget to focus on security at the infrastructure level, which costs a lot of money and takes a lot of engineering, and that is being diverted from the logic that goes into the solution, that's a problem, because that infrastructure and perimeter security can be solved by just not having it, mm-hmm. right? You know, like if it does run on, you know, John's computer under his desk, you know, that's actually probably better because it's going to run, it's going to go down. But, you know, as long as it's I don't want to say air gapped, but as long as it's not accessible from the network, as long as there's no user surface area on it, as long as it's not a computer that someone's browsing the web with, I don't want to say it's going to be more secure than, you know, Fort Knox built on Azure, but it eliminates the need for some of those risks that you then have to mitigate through the investment of time, effort, and money in engineering on the security and the infrastructure, time, effort, and money that could be spent that will probably be better spent on making sure the security within the application itself is robust.
Completely agree. I don't disagree at all with that. And it's when it comes to things like security or risk in the particular around what you're saying there, I like to think about the two different aspects. One is the surface area of that risk, right? And as you've said, if it's one small application dedicated to one user on a machine that is only ever used for that one task, it's got a very small surface area.
Yeah.
But then the alternative, the flip side of that too, is the blast radius of that of an attack on that system.
Yeah.
Right. And what other systems can that affect? Obviously, in this situation, there's not a lot. In other situations where you are building a system, and if it does suffer, the blast radius can actually take down a few other things, right? You might be on a shared database, and if the database server goes down, then you're taking down other systems too, right? We might be on shared infrastructure and start taking things down. So we do need to take these things into account. But that also comes with understanding the risks involved with engineering it in such a way.
Yeah.
And again, larger enterprise systems, enterprise developments, enterprise applications have all of this built in, or the intention, like that's part of the cost with those systems, or cost for the engineering effort is understanding, okay, well, we need extra database servers, we need extra redundancies, et cetera, to make sure that we maintain and we minimize that blast radius, minimize our surface area. But again, that comes at a cost.
Yep.
And there may be other ways to reduce.
And that cost isn't free.
It's not free. And like, it's a significant risk, right? There's the security risk. There's the, you know, the other systems and taking systems down and whatnot. But if things can be considered in a non-enterprise way, like you said, stick a server that's completely in quotes air gap, then you do minimize both the surface area and the blast radius of that system.
Yeah.
And for someone for an organization that's, you know, not publicly listed, that doesn't have to, you know, report to shareholders and whatnot, that may be sufficient. And the cost savings in doing that may be extremely significant.
Yeah.
And I guess this goes back to sort of the discussion to try and close off last week is like a lot of that bespoke software discussion comes from that enterprise level of thinking.
Yeah.
But that comes with its added cost. And when working with smaller companies, smaller teams, smaller budgets, there are some concessions that we can make to remove that enterprise level of robustness and enterprise thinking without sacrificing the security aspect.
Well, let's massively oversimplify it, right? So what we're saying is small businesses can't spend big enterprise money on bespoke software. But then the question is, do they have big enterprises risks? And the answer is no.
They don't have the big enterprise requirements.
Some of them may do, right?
Like, it's not even the risk, it's the requirement.
Well, the risk defines one part of the requirements.
Yeah, but like I said before, right? Their requirements might be we don't need 10 don't even need 10 concurrent users on this system.
Yeah.
It might only be one.
Yeah. Build it in WPF if it's one user.
Exactly. Right? Build a desktop app.
Yeah.
Right? I'm doing that at the moment, right? I'm building just a system that just pulls in data from various other platforms that's out there, and I still don't know how I'm going to present the data to the end user and have them actually trigger the system running. Right now, all it does is just generate an Excel report.
Yeah.
And for all intents and purposes, that's more than sufficient, right? Because it's only one, maybe two people that are going to be using this system.
Yeah.
What the front end and the UI looks like, I still don't know. It may just very well be a desktop app that they run that spits out an Excel report, right?
Yeah.
But that's my point. I don't need to build up, you know, a three-tier architecture, a three or four-tier architecture to build this system for one person to generate an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, that's how we lose to AI. I mean, it is, right? When you look at people saying, you know, like the whole thing about is developers' careers at risk? Do we need developers anymore? That's what people are talking about, is when a developer comes to you and says, you know, it's one thing to say, look, enterprise software, well-architected solutions have these requirements, so on and so forth. That's one thing. But to say to someone, you need to spend X amount of money and you need an N-tier architecture, blah, 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 to generate an Excel report when Claude can do it for them in seconds, that's how we lose.
Exactly. Absolutely. And like in this instance, the value add that I add on top of Claude is the simple fact that the person I'm working with did not realize what I'm talking about was possible.
Yeah.
Right. They were logging into four or five various different systems and aggregating the data themselves or looking for the data that are after.
Yeah.
And I just was walking past and I said, well, you know, we can automatically do that for you and just spit out in one spreadsheet.
Yeah.
The APIs are available for those platforms. We can just do that.
Yeah.
And it's the value add there is not in the build. It's in the knowing what's possible.
Yeah.
And no, it's not enterprise, but it doesn't need to be.
Yet. And that's it.
Yet. Until more people find out about it. But then you start to build it out.
Yeah. And that's fine because it's not an access database that lives in someone's shared folder.
All this being said, it still reminds me of one simple episode we did many, many moons back. Nobody gives a fuck about your code.
About your code. Yeah.
I don't That's give what. A fuck if your code is enterprise ready.
Well, you will when you have to maintain it, but sure.
Well, the end users don't give a fuck if your code is enterprise ready. They care that it does what it does.
Yeah.
Or does what it's supposed to do, I should say. And they might care that it's available whenever they need it, but that doesn't mean that they need it 99.9999% of the time. It just means they need it when they need it.
Yeah, but if when they need it is that 0.0000001% of the time, they're going to be really pissed off.
Yeah, but then they hit F5 and refresh and it's fine because we're talking. Yeah. Because that's how close, like that's what that five minds.
Quick aside, right? How many projects have you worked on where it's been modernizing or robustifying a solution because it just so happened that the CFO or the wrong person was the person that hit that 0.00001 incident?
A lot. Not as many hours has been spent solving those intermittent bugs that only show up in testing when that one person tests under one very certain circumstances and it's completely irrelevant to the main flow of what everyone's doing.
Yeah.
But you still need to fix it because now the QA has found it and you've got to resolve this one bug and you just waste all this time.
So yes,
no one goes down that path anyway.
I'm talking about a scenario where you've got a solution which runs just fine and it's up 99.9% of the time and it's been happily chugging along for years.
Oh, yeah.
But then one day the CEO tried to access it and it was down for that one moment. So now it's getting an injection of $1 million to get it completely re-architected.
Squeaky wheel gets the oil.
It doesn't need to be, but you know, that's what's happening. Yeah.
That's it. But look, it happens. But I don't know. I mean, that's what I wanted to cover, right?
Can I tell you a funny story?
Yes.
So one organization that I was at, we were trying to push to move to Exchange Online for years.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept getting blocked. Like no one could see the value in it. And they didn't want to spend the money. Then a senior executive was on holiday in China and couldn't access his email.
Yep.
Because they were on Google. They were on G Suite or whatever it was called at the time, Google Apps. And he couldn't access
Google
it.
Google not available China. In China.
No. Or at least it wasn't at the time. And at least Microsoft Exchange Online was at the time. So he came back and it's like, right, we're moving to Microsoft 365.
Yeah. And that's it. But yeah, no, I was just saying, like, I think that's what I wanted to cover in this episode is enterprise is great and is absolutely required when you are in that enterprise space and you have those enterprise constraints and you have the enterprise budget. But I don't know, is there scope to sort of term an enterprise light?
There is, but I think it's even simpler, right? I think what we would want people to, it's certainly smaller business owners, what we would want them to understand, the point we're trying to get across is if you have looked at the cost of bespoke software and it has seemed outside of your reach, there's a good chance that a big part of that cost was for things you don't need. So give Liam a call and let's see what we can do.
And look, I think it goes further than that. It could be not just seeing the cost, but it's being quoted.
Yeah.
Right. Like
yeah.
You've gone out to tender and you've asked the questions and or
that was what I meant.
You've gotten the quotes and you've spoken to someone and they come back with all these, you know, the price just seems so exorbitant. Like, there's a good chance that they're throwing things on that, yes, would be required if your business required them. And by that, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, there's extra engineering effort. Like I keep saying, there's extra engineering effort involved in making something available to so many more users. There's extra effort involved in making sure something's available so with so much uptime. There's extra effort involved, as you keep saying, around the security aspect. Now, security is one thing that I probably wouldn't be skimping on, definitely wouldn't be skimping on, but there's still ways that things can be done that may not pass that enterprise lens, that may not, you know, be signed off by in the enterprise space, but they're still perfectly fine within a smaller enterprise, within a smaller business that doesn't need that extra level provided by, you know, having that badge that says, yes, this is enterprise level software.
Yeah. I mean, look, you don't need a web application firewall for something that is only accessed internally.
Exactly. And there's a lot, especially in, like you said, you know, Azure's quite, I don't know, like the portal is quite accessible. It's far more accessible than AWS or GCP.
Yes, agreed.
But, you know, the costs can ramp up very, very quickly. And like, there's a lot. If you want to make something publicly available and secure and, as I keep saying, enterprise ready, the costs ramp up and scale significantly.
Yeah.
Right. Again, if you're a Sydney local business only serving with Sydney-based clients and you've only got Sydney-based staff, do you need to make sure that your application's geographically available in multiple regions all the time? You might want to make sure that there's a backup in a different region, but does it actually need to be available multi-region?
And there's ways of doing that as well, like use a VPN.
Right. But my point is, right, well, like if your data center's down for whatever reason, if it's down because the internet's down in your region, which, you know, hasn't happened for a while, but it has happened.
Yeah.
Chances are you're not getting on the internet anyway.
Maybe. Yep. Maybe.
Right. I don't know. I think there's just these kind of questions and these assumptions that people make around when it comes to bespoke software. And I think there's a lot of costs that can be saved by just reducing the scope.
Yep. And how do we reduce that scope? By being better consultants and actually asking the right questions and not just assuming that this massive enterprise solution is what every customer needs.
That's right. Because remember, not everyone gives a fuck about your code.
Nobody gives a fuck about your code.
No, I do.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're in agreement there. And next question then, what about consumer? And on that bombshell, it is very different. It's a very different scenario and it's one we should talk about, but I think that's another conversation.
When you say consumer, yeah. I know it's a different conversation, but now I need to get myself mentally prepared for that conversation.
Yeah. What if you are not building an app that's what we just defined as enterprise as being internal for businesses? What if you are building something that is public facing and is intended to be consumed by paying customers outside your business?
So a B2C app.
Could be B2B, could be B2C.
Okay. An external facing. Interesting. But again, I think I would look at it with a very similar lens in, like, you do need to do your risk analysis to identify where those risks are and what your risk appetite is.
Yeah.
But what is your expected user base? And, right, are you...
It meaningfully changes the answers to some of those questions, right? Like security. Well, it does have to be public facing, right? Uptime is like, well, does it matter that it's up all the time? Does it matter how many nines? Probably not. However, it's a lot easier. It's not easy and it's still very hard and it's something that you shouldn't do and something you have to contend with. But it's a lot easier to say to internal staff, we're sorry, it will be back up in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, yep, than it is to say that to paying external customers.
But there are ways to manage that.
Of course.
Right.
But then you're just moving where the investment of time, effort and money and mitigation is.
Correct. But I guess when I say there's ways to handle that, right? There's contractual ways to handle it with SLAs.
Yeah.
Right. You can set that expectation at the get-go.
Yeah.
At the outset. But like I said earlier too, right? I think it comes down to doing your risk analysis as well. Right? As an organization selling externally, how much downtime do I think my customers can handle? Because
it's a very, very complex thing to manage because you have to say, how much are my customers prepared to pay? And how much are they prepared to tolerate in terms of what seems reasonable as an SLA? And where is the right balance between those two things?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's hard, as you said earlier, this now starts to leak beyond that definition of enterprise software.
Yeah, it's a different use case.
Yeah. So is that a different episode?
Maybe. Whether or not it's a different episode, I do feel quite strongly that this is the end of this one.
And I'm speechless on that. No, look, I don't think there's anything else to say.
If you were like, fuck, I've got so much more to say. How do I...
I don't think I do anymore. I think we've said everything, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it sort of closes the loop from last week that I wanted to raise last week was bespoke software is available, is accessible across the board because it doesn't have to be enterprise grade.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. The costs associated with it are not the costs that every business needs to pay.
Correct. Sweet. So we're in agreement. I'll drink to that.
I'm empty. What were you drinking tonight?
I was drinking a Glendore TPR Tempranillo.
Very nice.
Yes, from the hilltops.
Rioja was my favorite for many years. I have been drinking an Oakvale Shiraz this evening.
See, Oakvale are just across the road from Glendore.
Yeah.
From memory, up in the Hunter.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's been so long since I've been up there. Need to get back up.
Same. Yeah, it's been a while.
Yes. But I'll be the near there. Bringing that is, sorry?
I'll be nearer there next week than I am.
Yes. That's right. Tell us about that.
What's to tell?
Well, you sent me a message the other day saying that you've got a call up to Slash New.
Ah, yes. So, yeah, it looks like they had someone who's no longer available. So I did actually have a submission and Clay asked me if I still wanted to do that, which I do, obviously. Otherwise, I wouldn't have submitted it. So like I said last time, I was really excited to be heading back to Slash New. It's a great conference and I really enjoyed it last year. And it's not one that I've spoken at before. Mm-hmm. So this will be my first time talking at Slash New. So that's exciting. And I submitted a talk called Everything is Too Hard.
Just thinking, did you change it to Enterprise is Too Hard?
I was about to say, it looks like thinking of a response is too hard.
Yes. No, life is too hard.
Yeah.
It should be good. I'm really disappointed I couldn't make it up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it. It's a good conference. It's, you know, yeah, it's good. And like, you know, there's certainly some great talks on the agenda this year that I'm looking forward to seeing. So yeah, I'm excited about that.
Do you know what day you fall on?
I'm on day two. I'm on Thursday.
Right towards the end.
About halfway through. Halfway. Yeah. I'm just after lunch on Thursday.
Nice. Now, so by the time this comes out, everyone's got 24 hours to see you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But yeah, like next time, hopefully, last time I went to Slash New, I had a lot to talk about. And hopefully I will this year as well. So I think next time we'll be talking about Slash New.
Yeah, should be good. Can't wait to hear it. I think we've dragged this one on for longer than it needs to. So I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Sweet. So now the recording's going, it's nothing to talk about.
Yeah, now that we've started recording, I've just run out of things to say.
Yeah.
And that's it for this podcast.
Well...